In addition to this being the keynote of our 2011 affiliates meeting, it's also the first talk in our distinguished lecture series for the fall. And the next two are coming up real soon now, and you might be interested in those. This coming Thursday, the 27th, so a week from tomorrow, Bill Gates will be speaking here. We're really looking forward to that. And on November 1st, James Hamilton, who's in the audience here today from Amazon.com, formerly Microsoft and before that IBM, will be speaking. So we've got a set of great talks lined up for the early and late fall. We're glad to have you here for the first one, and we hope to see you for Bill and James and the ones that follow. So thanks for being here. Today is a real pleasure for us. Sujal Patel in a second will introduce Joe Tucci, who's the chairman and CEO of EMC. Sujal is the co-founder with our alum, Paul Mikesell of Isilon, a phenomenally successful storage systems company funded originally by our friends at Madrona Venture Group, who've been of great help to many of our companies out of UW Computer Science and Engineering. And EMC last 9 months ago in January or so acquired Isilon. So it's now the Isilon division of EMC. So it's great to welcome Sujal here today, who will introduce you to our keynote speaker, the head of EMC, Joe Tucci. Sujal Patel.
My name is Sujal Patel. I'm the founder of a company here called Isilon Systems that was founded about a decade ago. And today's been an exciting day for us. We've had the pleasure of having Joe Tucci in town. And we've been talking about with the press and with industry and regional leaders about the fact that Isilon is in the midst of a significant expansion. We're growing rapidly post-acquisition by EMC. We're hiring a lot of talent in the Seattle area. And this morning we were celebrating moving to a new 140,000 square foot facility in Pioneer Square. And really the highlight of the message today was really around the fact that, you know, Isilon is building out a significant presence in the Seattle area for innovation. And over the next 15 months, we expect to hire 200 jobs. Most of those are going to be engineering oriented. And I'm very pleased to be in front of this audience because one of our favorite places, as you would imagine, to get great talent is from the University of Washington. It's from our institution, which has a phenomenal computer science program and has been a very important part of our company. My co-founder is from the UW. Many of our employees are from the UW. And for those that might be looking, we have a job fair tomorrow. Isilon, we represented, will be looking for graduates from the UW. One of the other things that we were celebrating here this morning was the fact that, you know, Seattle is a great place for innovative companies to be founded and started. Isilon is a company that I founded when I was 26 years old, over 10 years ago. I didn't know how to run a company, but I had a vision for how we could transform the storage industry with a new architecture. And with a lot of hard work and some luck along the way and the right vision for how the world was going to evolve, we built a business that did a couple $100 million in revenue last year. That grew to about 850 employees as of today within the Isilon Storage Division of EMC, and it led to an acquisition by EMC Corporation, the world's largest storage company, for $2.5 billion that closed at the end of last year. Over the course of the next 30 minutes, you're going to hear from a man that I have come to know over the course of the last 2 years and respect deeply. And Joe Tucci's been the CEO of EMC for a little bit over a decade and has really led that company through a period of revitalization, going from a company that had literally just a couple of storage platforms to today a company which on a consolidated basis owns the majority stake in VMware, the most important software asset in the next generation virtualized data center. We have a wide range of products in our storage portfolio and market share leadership, including acquisitions like Data Domain from a few years ago and Isilon from last year. And we've transformed our business under Joe's leadership to a software and services business where the majority of our revenue comes from these high margin, high value offerings to our customers. That's really a testament to what Joe's accomplished. And he's going to talk to you a little bit about why this is such an exciting time from the perspective of transformation of the IT space. And so without further ado, I want to introduce Joe Tucci, Chairman and CEO of EMC Corporation. Thank you.
Now, good afternoon. How's everybody doing?
Great.
So I guess I got to look back here. Okay. What I really want to do is get to the Q&A portion of today's call. But I'll give you a little bit of story about EMC and some of the things that I viscerally believe deeply are going to really happen in this IT industry that I think we all share a love for, or you wouldn't be here. You know, and as I started to say, I believe, you know, you are all mostly in the computer science group here, from the computer science school? Okay, so it's safe to say that we all share a love of this industry we call information technology or IT. But I'm going to submit to you that IT stands for more than information technology. It really stands for an industry that's in transition. Because I really believe that if you look at what's happening at IT today, we're at the kind of in the early innings. I used to play baseball, so I use a lot of baseball analogies, so bear with me. We're in the early innings of what is going to be just a monstrous change in this industry. And one of the few advantages about being in this industry 42 years, and yes, I've been in this industry 42 years, and I started out back here in mainframes as a assembler programmer, and then I went into systems programming, is, you know, you saw these waves of change come and really affect this industry. And it's really interesting, being from Boston, I particularly focused on this trend of the mini computers, because if you recall, that mini computer wave happened in Boston and around Boston, around the 128 Beltway, and that's where Data General was, that's where Digital Equipment was, that's where Wang was, that's where Prime was, that's where Apollo was. Honeywell was in the mini computer business, and they were there. So this was the seed of where all this happened. And not some of those companies, but every one of those companies is now gone. Every one. Now, Honeywell's not gone. They've been gone to great success, but they're in flight systems and other activities. They're gone out of IT. The other companies are gone. So it's really interesting. And when I, even if I came back here into mainframes, you know, the one that's notably the success was IBM. All the other companies were in the mainframe, you know, Control Data, Univac, Burroughs, and there's many NCR. I mean, these companies, again, are either all gone or at least gone from the computer. So these waves are tremendously disruptive and tremendously opportunistic. So what I look at these waves is, how are you going to navigate them through? That's my job as a CEO, to take a company and navigate and understand that these changes are coming. You know, deal with the disruptions, and in some cases, embrace the disruption and focus the company on the opportunity. Because what I have noticed, that the companies that have done well are the companies that played an offensive game. The companies that tended to get gobbled up in these changes and lose their way are companies that played a lot of defense to defend their current position and didn't play enough offense. So it's pretty simple. I got to apply that lesson every day and make sure that we do things, even if they're disrupted to core franchises like we have. But it means for all of you, you picked the heck of a good industry to be in, because this new wave is going to be huge. Now, what is happening to cause us to want to change? And I'm going to tackle it from a different position, because I don't want to talk to this group about technology, because you're all smarter than I am. Even though I started out technically, I did a lot of other things in life, and I'm not nearly as deeply technical as I'm sure most of you are. So what I look at change is, yes, technology has to answer a change, but the reason for the change is usually driven by business and what's happening around us. What I'm saying is, I'm going to give you three reasons why I think we need a change. One is going to be under the heading of a budget dilemma. One is an information deluge, and one is just cybersecurity. I could put others up here, but these are three that I think are just driving this whole phenomenon of why we got to do things differently and why the old way is just not going to work. First thing is, this statistic has been true for over 10 years. 73%, about three quarters of IT budgets, are spent maintaining existing infrastructures, existing applications. And only a quarter of IT budget goes to do something that's truly new that can help propel a business or make a government more intimate with its constituencies and provide better services. Right? So again, this has not changed. Most of the technologies that we talked about affected the CapEx side of an IT budget, but the bigger piece of an IT budget is OpEx, and we've never really effectively attacked that. So, you know, I could have put this slide up 10 years ago and it would have been true, and I could still put it up today and it's true. And again, we have to change this phenomenon. This world is becoming too crowded, too many opportunities, too many problems we got to solve. Second thing is we're being deluged by information, right? This is a study that IDC did, and I don't give it credibility unto itself, but happens to be that the last study that IDC did back in 2000 when they predicted information growth in a decade of 2000 through 2000, the end of 2009, they are remarkably close. So this group of scientists that worked on this, many in university professors worked on this, they basically believe that in this decade, so what is this decade? January 1st, 2010 to December 31st, 2019. In this decade, information that we have to manage, grow, get value out of will grow 44 times. And the other interesting thing, having been around a long time, when I started, we were measuring data in megabytes, right? And this thing now has jumped to where they're measuring it in zettabytes. So they said, this study said that in 2010 we would have 2009 we were started out. By the end of that year, we had 2.9 zettabytes. And of course, when we get to 2019, we'll be dealing with 35. And you guys all know this because you're into computer science, but that's what a zettabyte looks like. It's a number with 21 zeros. It's just a lot. It's big. Even I could figure that out. And of course, this is a big piece of what brought us to interest in great company Iceland Asugil, is 90% of this information that's being created is unstructured. And of course, we're using this term now that the industry has really caught on to. I'm not going to be like Al Gore and claim that we created this name, but I think we were the first to use it a lot. And we got a lot of pressure by some of the companies like Gartner and IDC of the world to use the term extreme data. We stayed with big data, and the industry is basically now calling it big data. So big data is one of those things it's easier to describe by using examples. So what's causing big data? You know, video rendering, the ability that, we all demand to see anything that was ever created and put on and digitized to be able to view that program or that movie or that YouTube video, if you will, on demand, on command, anytime we want. The ability to make the average 3D movie now, when it's made, when they take all the cameras and they collect the data in the central part, it's about a petabyte of data to create, a movie like Avatar. And you look how many 3D movies are coming out now. So the ability to capture all that, and the video surveillance, genomic sequencing, geophysical or seismic processing, I mean, medical imaging, PACS data, every time you turn around, the cuts of data and the amount of pixels on the data from an MRI, say, gets more pixels, finer grains. So, and of course, mobile computing and of course, things like Facebook and Twitter. I mean, just phenomenal amounts of information, right? And again, if you think about it, we have to deal with this data and make sure we can get value out of this data. So, again, the last thing is we need to do this securely. If you go to any board of directors, any board, and if I'm asked, which I'm asked, I'm on a couple of outside boards. Obviously, I chair VMware and EMC, so I have pretty good exposure to boards, and I'll probably attend 3 or 4, at least probably 5 outside board meetings. Number one interest, anytime I'm there, even though all this is exciting, is the board always goes to security. They want to know, is one of our most important assets, I happen to believe the most important asset in any enterprise is the people. Then you have applications and business processes that support the business. And then you have the information itself. Those are the things that are important to a company. And of course, that information aspect, they want to make sure, right, darn sure, that information is protected, risk is minimized, good governance is being adhered to, and, we have compliance that'll meet any regulator's test. I mean, that is what's very important to boards. They want to keep their name and the company's name out of the papers. Because as you probably noticed, papers don't like to write a lot of good stories these days about CEOs and boards and companies. So it's a pretty good idea. So again, and this just gives you one statistic. I could go on and on about this subject forever. But, and a matter of fact, every CIO that I showed this to says that's way light. And of course, this study says that that an average company is attacked 300 times a week. And if you're a big company, as somebody who's here from Amazon, I heard, I bet you Amazon is, where's the Amazon fellow? This would be way light, right? You wish you were only attacked 300 times a week. So it's amazing. We get attacked many, you know, multiples, 10 times, a magnitude more than that within our EMC empire, the VMware empire. So it's amazing what happens. So again, we need to address these issues in a different way. And what we believe is that, another important statistic. This is kind of important for you. This is good news, bad news. From the same study, to deal with, to make sure that we get more money spent on doing things that help propel a business, to make sure that we can deal with 44 times as much data, to make sure that we solve all the cybercrime in the world, and about 50 other things. IT staffing will up about 46% over that same decade. So we'll have to do all of that with only 46% more people, which is pretty good. There's not a lot of industries. Good news, bad news, right? Good news is there's not a lot of industries that are going to expand by 46% in this time frame, right? So you pick one that is. Congratulations. The bad news is that's a lot to do with only 46% more people, right? 44 times more data, only 46% more people. Pretty amazing. We better go to unparalleled levels of productivity and do things differently. So we basically believe that cloud computing is one of the phenomena that's going to help answer those three, and I really four dilemmas, because the IT staffing budgets are just not going to go up as much. So how do we deal with these and other problems? I could have, if I just picked three big ones I think are important, and other problems with only 46% more people. Pretty daunting task, but pretty exciting for all of you, I think. So what we've done is we've dedicated our company to look at those, to really work on those metrics that I just talked to you about, or those issues that I talked to you about. So let me talk to what I think is happening. The first thing is basically to transform infrastructure in what we call into private clouds. So medium and large companies who have data centers today can transform those data centers. And basically, if you look at what makes an Amazon data center so efficient, right, is they have all x86 technology. Right, you go into a data center of a big bank, you're going to see mainframes, two or three flavors of Unix. They'll have Linux farms, Windows farms, and many, many old things left around. So it gives, and for the first time, the power from Intel of the x86 microprocessor and the Nehalem chip, the next Nehalem chip comes out very shortly here, and it's going to have 12 cores, you know, massive memory capabilities, great quality of service. So now we can stack up these merchant microprocessors that are given to us by Intel and others, and then standardize that infrastructure. We can put a layer of OS, which we're doing at VMware, right? So that's what VMware is building, a cloud OS that basically can take that infrastructure and based on the policy and service levels that you set for that application, it will assign the proper amount of cores for compute, for storage, and for network. And you can have, and built with built-in security and automation, and I'm kind of completing the picture for you, and I'll show you that in stages, and you can do this thing in a much more efficient manner, much lighter weight. So basically what we need is to help companies move to these new x86-based private clouds. And the good news is at the Gartner conference recently, 35% of companies said they are implementing this kind of private cloud. And about 30% more said they will do so this year. So it's pretty exciting, a lot of opportunity to do that. And if you watch the growth of VMware, the connection, you all know the connection between EMC and VMware, yes? We bought VMware back in 2004, and then we took 10% public, and then of course through employee ownership, you know, about and a lot of buybacks, we've kept our ownership at 80%, and the public owns the other 20. So it's still consolidated, it's still part of the EMC family, even though they're a publicly traded company. So again, that's what we're doing here. And at the same time, we believe there's going to be a great opportunity in the public cloud, and there's a bunch of service providers that are standing up similar VMware-based, EMC storage-based infrastructures. And it gives these companies the ability, when you get a burst, when you want to do some prototyping, when you want to do test and development, when you want to run tier two, tier three applications, or no, there's no reason you couldn't run tier one out there, you get to do it with the same set of controls, So you're setting the policies, you're setting the service levels, and what infrastructure it runs on is very flexible. If you think of it, if you think of an application today, it completely comes down, which is why it's so expensive, is the application owns the infrastructure, and then the application basically has to size that infrastructure for the peak of the day to peak of the year. So you're paying for infrastructure all the time that you don't need very much at a time. So this is a much lighter way, much more fundamental way to do it. And again, what we think, the hybrid cloud is going to be the big winner, where companies are going to build, there's no doubt, for a lot of reasons, security one of them, they're going to, and the fact that they have a lot of existing applications, which I'll show you in a second, they'll build, but they're going to want to federate in with public clouds too. And we'll find ways to do this and even take some of our upper level value proposition and even work with companies like Amazon in the future. On the application side, a lot of transformation has to take place there. So through the miracles of virtualization, you can encapsulate those applications in virtual machines. And we now are reached the case where there's more virtual machines shipped by far than there is physical machines. So it's about 62% of applications now are virtualized right out of the gate. And they're now working with the power of the new Mahalan processors and advances we've made with vSphere 5. You now can basically, it's the rare application which can't be virtualized and get superb performance. So we can take these older existing applications, replatform them on x86, and run them again under a virtual infrastructure, a cloud OS. At the same time, though, if you go to the startup land, where a lot of you are tapped in, you'll see that the new coding language is not C and C++ anymore. It's moving more towards these frameworks like Spring, like Ruby on Rails, like Python, like PHP, like Nodes, and there's several more coming out all the time. So in other words, when you do this, now you can get another layer of intimacy with the OS that runs a data center. And then you virtualize everything that goes with it, like the load balancers and firewalls, and then you can take these with the policies and move them, slide them around, whether it be on your cloud or a public cloud, you can slide them around quite easily and quite openly. And of course, the third thing, which is really going to be the killer app of this new wave, is what we call big data applications, which is how do you do these data analytics of this data you stored? You know, even though you say, here's a CEO of a company that's known for storage, even though you're now learning we do a lot more storage, here's a company, the CEO of the leading storage company by far, and he's saying, why would you store something if you don't think you can get value of it sometime in the future, right? Think about it. And we store a lot we don't get value out of. And part of the reason we don't get value out of it is because we don't have the means to get it. So basically, what I think the killer app, right? If you go back to those waves, each wave had their killer apps, right? When you went to the mainframe minicomputer wave, they basically automated a lot of financial applications and departmental engineering applications. When you went to the next wave, the killer apps were ERP, CRM, HR. And in this wave, I'm quite convinced the killer apps are going to be real time. How do I do real time data analytics on massive data sets? And this is used scale-out parallel processing. So again, you want to be able to handle all three types of data, big data applications, your existing apps. You know, how many apps are there in the existing world? Millions and millions and millions. How many dollars? Billions and billions. You can't throw them out. These got a life cycle just like a capital good. You got to get your money's worth. So again, you want to run them, and then of course, there's these new flexible framework apps that you want to build for your new work. So again, you have to handle all three kinds. We have activities that do that in what we call the vFabric layer of our strategy. And then of course, at the end of the day, you know, it used to be, you know, you got Bill Gates here tomorrow, I'll tell him I said this, but it used to be pretty simple for a while. You know, everything was a Windows device. Now all of a sudden, you know, that controls, you know, it's Apple devices of many different kinds, different screen sizes. So Android devices of many different screen sizes. You still have Windows devices. You have, I'm so old, I carry around a RIM, BlackBerry. So you have a lot of devices, and they're going to come and go. And what we need to really do is have a world which we're going to provision the user, the person, for a set of capabilities, not the device, and then you can go by any devices you want, and we'll make sure you get the security and the way to come in. So kind of these are the problems that we're working on. And of course, when we get up here from a storage angle, we got to get massive amounts of big data. We got to get massive amounts of storage that processes really quickly on very lightweight, inexpensive frames. And that's part of the problem Isilon works on. When you work up in the end user computing, you know the cheapest cost of computing is that 500 gigabyte drive you have in your desk type that costs you $100, right? Now we got to take that. We got to make sure it's backed up and still preserve that $100. So you can see how, and then you got to do this securely. So you can see how the different pieces of the company that we're building come together to act on this strategy. So the new layering of IT is this, and then of course on this side you want to build in security, not layer it on. If you think of the security industry, it was totally a bolt-on. Because if you go back to the first wave mainframes and mini computers, what did you have? You had a proprietary DECnet. Right? If you're a DEC, you had DECnet. If you're IBM, you had SNA. Right? If you're Wang, you had WangNet. Then the end of it, you had a proprietary terminal. In IBM land, it was called 3270. You guys are looking at me, you probably don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But believe me. So therefore, you know, you didn't have to worry about a firewall. You didn't have to worry about antivirus. Then all of a sudden, the proprietary networks got replaced by IP. The end user terminals got replaced with PCs. They got intelligence. Guess what happens? You got viruses. You got firewall intrusions. So what happens? VCs are smart. They fund companies like Checkpoint to deal with firewall. They fund companies like McAfee and Symantec to deal with the antivirus. And everything that's been done in security has been bolted on the side. Same thing with the management suite. So that management suite has got to be replaced with true automation that's built in. It's got to be, and the security has got to be built into these new framework, to these new cloud OSs. And that's what we're doing also. And that's how the other pieces of what we have in our family fit in. So again, what's the promise of all of this? Well, a whole new level of efficiency, lower cost. A whole new fashion of control. That control is going to be, don't worry, Mr. User, right, Mr. Developer. You just tell me what service levels and what policies you need me to meet, and I'll assign what tier of storage I want it on, how many cores I need, et cetera, right? How much memory I need. I'll do all of that. And I will meet your policies, your service, and your cost metrics that you set. Those are the three things I'm going to deal with. So the way you control these new systems is through policy, service levels, and cost. And then you let the automation take over instead of the old-fashioned management tools. Choice, we got to give you choice. I mean, God forbid if you want to use VMware and you don't want to use Isilon storage or EMC storage, we're going to let you do that. If you want to use another cloud OS and you want to use EMC storage, we're going to let you do that. We're going to find ways of, even if you want to automate out to or federate out to Amazon Web Services, we're going to find a way to do that, because we got to give you choice. Now, at the end of the day, the customers are going to have to make decisions, right? It's like all of a sudden you code in a database. You're probably not going to take that database out for quite a few years. So you're going to pick a cloud OS. Right, we hope it's us, but we're not going to lock in. And I think that's really important to give choice. And of course, it's going to give you a whole new level of agility. And that's where, this is what goes through my mind every day. Because if you don't do it this way, I think we'll get beat. Because we're going up against a lot bigger companies, right? I mean, you got IBM trying to play a game here, Microsoft's trying to play this game here, you've got HP, you got Cisco, you got a lot of companies that are bigger than we are. So we got great size. You know, we just finished last quarter at $4.98 billion, so you multiply that times four. You know, we're running at about a $20 billion run rate. We got good market cap. We have $10 billion in cash. So, but again, these other guys are just bigger. So we have got to be smarter, faster, more nimble, and make sure that our key assets pay off. So, in short, we believe that. And it's, you know, just like words of advice, I just think as you think of your own careers, I think where you see this cloud opportunity and this big data opportunities at that intersection, it's going to be great opportunities for you, massive opportunities. And I'm quite sure that when we look back, or who's ever up here 10 years from now, looking back, like I just did a journey back to the mainframe, they'll say that the companies and the people that were specialized on this intersection did incredibly well. So again, how are we doing that guy? So I've had this thing in my mind, and it really came by being in Boston and watching all those kind of dead soldiers, you know, going by the digital plant and by the Wang plant and by the Data General facilities. By the way, we bought Data General. But so when I, and what it says here is we're going to spend a lot of money in R&D, and as we spend 12% of revenues in R&D, so if we're going to do close to $20 billion this year, that's $2.4 billion in R&D. That's a lot of money, right? And we have about 16,000 plus engineers that produce, that get paid for out of that $2.4 billion, right? But there's no way that I'm going to, that one of the things that happened on that 128 Beltway is it became too insular. And I know there's going to be a lot of innovation that doesn't happen inside our company. So what we did is we have a budget that's pretty close to equal, where we buy great technology companies like what Sujal did with Isilon, like what I found with VMware, like we did with Data Domain, like we did with Greenplum for data analytics. So what we do is we kind of balance that. But if you think of those two together, we're spending almost $5 billion a year on technology. And that's why I said at our heart and soul and our core, we have got to make, I've got to make sure every day I wake up that we don't get lost, that we stay a technology company. I don't know what the hell this is. But anyway. Oh. Yeah, right now we opened up our 85th country. We do about half our business inside the U.S., about half out. We just crossed 52,000 people. So one of my people must have thrown his slide in there. And this is kind of where we have our major facility. But I think the exciting thing here is on the back of what we did at Isilon, we have about 700 people now all in the greater Seattle area. And this is going to be our next major hub of where we're going to build out a lot of technology strength. Hence Sujal's shameless recruiting of all of you. I would never do such a thing. But I got a card for each one now. So at any rate, this kind of gives some of the statistics. This is what we were last year, where we ranked, how big we were, how much money we have, and all the bragging points. So obviously the most important bragging point, if we do it right, is the world expects us to be about 16-17% bigger this year than we were last year, which at this size, growing at that percentage, says you're doing most things right. So, you know, from 17 to close to 20 this year. And we have the market cap and the cash and everything to fund these goals if we stay focused and move faster, which has got to be our advantage. There's people say nice things about us, you don't care. And because I don't want to rush through it, but I really want to get to you know, what's on your mind. And I always find when I do these sessions, I guess I'm here to somewhat say something to you, but you energize me at the end of the day a lot more than I always energize you. So I really want to hear from you and what's on your mind and what you think. I think they got some mics they want you to talk in, but you can scream and I'll repeat it if you can't get to it.
I'll scream.
Okay.
So cyber war, the recent book about cyber war. One question is, does the country defend, as China is doing, right? Or do individual companies defend? And so I wondered your thoughts about that for the United States, how, as a country, what's that division of labor between individual companies, organizations, and governmental bodies?
Yeah. You know, that is...
Repeat the question.
Okay. I'll shorten the question. There's a book that came out recently, Cyber Wars, which I'm about this much into. But in premise, this is a major issue that happens between countries. In my humble opinion, and I'll give it to you in prose, there's kind of three classes now that you have to be careful of. Right? You can hear my baseball career coming out now, okay? You got the pros, the semi-pros, and the amateurs, right? Which are all trying to, you know, invade us and hack us, right? I mean, the pros are what's called the nation states, right? And they're got the smartest people, they got unlimited resources, and, you know, if they're coming at you, it's incredibly tough. You've also got organized crime getting into the game. They're the semi-pros. They're not as good as the pros, but they're pretty darn good, and they're doing it for money as opposed to gains that you can imagine a nation state would have, right? And then you have just 100 amateurs trying to be smart, to prove that they're smarter than the next person, right? And what happens, and you really need different answers for each one of those. And of course, I think your question deals with the top tier. When you know it's a nation state attacking you or one of your valuable companies here in the U.S., how do you retaliate? What is your course of action, right? How do you handle this not so cold war?
What do you think the proper role is for individual companies, technology companies, who can provide defensive measures or offensive measures versus the federal government in defending individuals and organizations in the United States from these attacks?
I think the federal government's got to play a big role, okay? On the other side, we have to have a whole new level of awareness, because what the APTs tend to do, as you know as well as I do, is they're going to come in, they're going to use social networking to learn as much as they can about an employee in a company who has access to steal their identity to come in as that person. Therefore, your conventional tools do not pick them up. You got to look for abnormal behavior. So there's a whole set of new tools that we're building and a whole set of companies that are in the startup land, several of which we've bought, one called Archer, one called NetWitness on our side, that are kind of looking for the different patterns, because you've got to now look for patterns, because I can't keep you out because somebody came in exactly with your credentials. What am I going to do? Right? It's you as far as the system is concerned. You're allowed to be here. But you have patterns that I've, and this is where kind of being in data, big data analytics is important for us, because we're seeing so many events now, you can't use the correlation engines that you used to use. Because now we got to look, this is big data. Now we got to look at massive number and look for different patterns, because what's your name?
Ben.
So when Ben came in, Ben always did these several things. Now we see Ben came in, right? And it's fine for Ben to come in the system, but now Ben's doing things he's never done before. And we got to raise flags immediately when that happens, which means we got to analyze massive amounts of data in real time. So what we're doing there is we're actually taking a page from our Green Plum and data analytics, which is massively scaled out to build new plans. So basically, there's different answers, and I don't want to get into the political side of it, but there's a lot there too. My friends from Twitter.
Hi. So I had a question about your, easy to use cloud platform. Kind of. If you want to make it something for programmers to be writing code in a way that is high performance and actually can do work on, these new 12-core processors, yet you're saying that you're going to make it really easy. So you just specify SLAs, and you'll kind of do the work behind the scenes to figure out, what kind of hardware it's going to run on. How are people in this room that are, getting trained to write software at a very optimized level going to be able to take advantage of the hardware that they're going to be using if they don't really know what it is?
The question is, again, does it matter? Things that I used to worry about. When I started and I came out of school, my classmates were incredibly jealous. This is because back when I graduated, I started in 1970. So when I graduated and I went, there was no such thing. Maybe one school had it, but certainly not where I went. There's no such thing as a computer science degree, right? So I literally never saw a computer, as we used to call them back then. Never saw one. Never programmed one. Never went near one. But some company gave me an aptitude test, and they said, I think we can make you into a programmer. And they sent us to their school, which was like a boot camp, right? So when I graduated from that school, what you did is you went 10 weeks boot camp. You went days, nights, weekends for 10 weeks. Then you went under a mentor for 6 months in the field. Then you came back for 6 more intensive weeks. And then they let you fly on your own a little bit, right? So when I got to fly on my own a little bit, my classmates were incredibly jealous. They said, holy cow, you got to go there? Those guys have 2 mainframes, and they both have 512K. 512K of memory. Right, 2 of them. Wow, this was huge. And each one had 16 20 megabyte disk drives. Right? So when we were writing, you know how the Y2K problem came up? Because when we were writing, we had to watch every single byte. So some smart guy someplace developed a date and time algorithm, which everybody put in. And of course, to save bytes, they never put in enough to get to the year 2000. Right? So it was called a macro back in those days, right? Those of you who were old assembler programmers. So, which there can't be that many here. but you understand? So we worried about all those things. Now you, as a program, you're not going to worry about that. So what I'm suggesting is there's going to be an age where you're just not going to worry about that because you just know it's going to work. Now, are we there yet? Do you have enough trust in us yet? No, but that's where the world's going to go. And it really is going to go to you could spend more time, you know, writing your high performance in the application itself than worrying about what's happening in the infrastructure layer. There's going to be a complete cleaving. I mean, Amazon's got to agree with us on this point, right? And that's what it's going to, so we got to get to that level of trust, but that's where it's going to go. So just like if you had told me back then, if I was in this audience, that I didn't have to worry about my disk utilization or how many bytes I used to write that program, I'd have said, you got to be kidding me. And that's basically what I'm telling you. Is that?
You have a huge acquisition budget. For those of us that do startups or invest in startups, are you going to continue the pattern of buying a few mega purchases, or smaller companies going to get swept up in the EMC web as well?
I haven't done any mega purchases. None.
Well, $2 billion is a pretty big one.
Well, it depends what you're talking about, right? Here's what the formula I use, and I'm not recommending this formula, but I just can tell you what we've done, okay? And I got one of my board members here, so he can tell you this is true. The best acquisitions we've done, right? And these are been incredibly, incredibly successful acquisitions. Each one of them was more than 10 times revenues when I bought them. But the biggest one was under $300 million in revenue, the biggest one. Like Sudra just told you, Isilon was $200 million. I spent $2.25 billion for it, right? So that's 11 times revenue, round numbers, right? Mm-hmm. VMware was $60 million in revenue when we bought it. Spent $635 million, a little more than 10 times revenue. See, Sudra, you did better than, you know, Data Domain, right? Was doing, I think, $285 million in revenue or something like that, right? So we haven't bought big revenue company. RSA was around $300 million. You know, so, you know, the combination of Data Domain and Avamar, which is forms our data protection unit, you know, that business went way past $1 billion. So we five times the growth, five times the, increased the growth rate. I've said to the world that Isilon and another little kind of internal startup we did called Atmos together would be over $1 billion inside of 18 months. And it was $200 million, and the other one was very small revenue. So again, yes, I spent big money because what I tried to do was buy the best of breed. Not number two, not the second best, not the third, the best. But I have not bought a lot of revenue. So when I started my first full year as CEO, we did $5.4 billion in revenue, and this year we'll do close to 20. So we had good growth, and very little of that revenue was bought because the companies we bought were smaller. So VMware this year, their last quarter was $980 million or something like that in revenue. So VMware's, I forgot exactly what it was, but something like that. So VMware's now approaching a $4 billion run rate, right? But we started out at 60. So the growth came after. So what I'm saying is in size of company, VMware had 310 employees. How many did you have, Sujal, when we bought? 350 employees. So we haven't bought, you know, we haven't done anything of where we've bought thousands of people or billions of revenue or even more than $300 million of revenue. So it's been really by the best. When we felt strategically we needed something, we went and bought the best. We paid up for it. And where we've done that, all I can tell you is it's worked for us. Because what do we then apply? You know, we have, you know, 14,000 salespeople. Sujal had how many? Sujal, how many did you have? This is your part of the thing. How many sales reps did you have when we bought you?
We had probably
100. Yeah, 100. Right? So obviously, can we get them into more places? Can we, and that, so those are the concepts of what we've used.
Thanks.
Maybe one more question.
So we'll go back a little bit with you. In the past, the days of Bell Labs and other large companies, and today things have changed.
They sure have.
What is the responsibility for leading organizations, leading technology companies today to fund basic R&D in universities?
I think it's strong. One of the things that I just that we've been talking about, talked to Ed and Hank about it. I just was talking to Mike, your president, about it. Is I really believe we need to. It's not going to be a large number of universities. You know, be less than I have fingers here, but we're going to work very closely with them because I really do think that's you know, the corn seed, so to speak, right? That this is the seed of the future. You are the seed of the future. So how do we get, if we can have you using some of our technology, if we can have you having a responsibility to help us advance some of our technology or do a new piece of technology in an adjacency to what we're doing, this is something we have to do. It's something we, if I was going to give myself a grade today, I'd give myself someplace between a C minus and a D plus. And that is something we have to do. And that was part of the discussions that we've had here with the people I just mentioned. So a great point. And not something we do as well as we need to do. Hey, thanks everyone. You guys are great. I really appreciate it. Good being with you.
Thanks, sir. So before we let Joe off the stage, I realize he's a baseball guy, but this year we do football at the University of Washington, so I want to present Joe with this Husky football jersey. Keep you on the back.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe, very much.
Thank you.
Thanks all of you.